From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A longtime Dole supporter and disabled activist casts his lot with the president.
Bob Dole is a brother in disability. He has supported people with disabilities in many ways for many years. But now he has joined the Gingrich group in a tragic politics of retreat that I believe will condemn millions of Americans with disabilities to unemployment, welfare, and charity, to isolation in institutions and back rooms, to poor health, and for many, to early death.
A look at one of the hottest congressional races in the country, this in Northwest California, where union money threatens Republican incumbent Frank Riggs, and a political action committee that contributes people power, not money. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Tucson, Arizona. Two political opponents of GOP Congressmember Jim Colby have admitted posting signs claiming the openly gay congressmember has AIDS. Colby called the signs a venomous lie. Responding to a tip from a witness, police questioned Reform Party candidate Ed Finkelstein and Republican Joseph Sweeney, the two men admitting posting the signs. The case is currently under investigation. And it was a landslide for President Clinton, nearly 55% of the vote, 41 states in his column. But he will have to wait until next week to break out the champagne. These were not real votes. Getting a taste of democracy, 5.7 million students cast ballots yesterday in a national mock election. They used the spotlight to give Clinton more than 54% of the popular vote, majorities in 41 states, and 500 electoral votes out of a possible 538. John Huang, the Democratic fundraiser at the center of the rising controversy over foreign political donations, visited the White House at least 65 times this year, often for hours at a time, according to the Secret Service. The records did not show what Huang's business was at the White House, but they indicate he was a much more frequent visitor than the White House has acknowledged previously. News of Huang's visits prompted a Republican demand that President Clinton explain what he was doing there. Republicans have made Huang's fundraising role a campaign issue and want Congress to investigate what they call improper and possibly illegal contributions to the Democratic Party. Huang is aligned with the Riyadis, a wealthy Indonesian banking family. Riyadi family members and their associates have contributed heavily to Clinton's reelection campaign. Bob Dole is getting a helping hand on the campaign trail today. The former President Bush, is to join Dole for a rally in Tampa, Florida this morning. Afterwards, the Republican challenger heads for rallies in Miami and Atlanta. And Dole is expected to be joined on his campaign plane by former President Ford. Ford and Bush are the last two Republican presidents who were beaten by Democrats. And President Bill Clinton mulled proposed legislation to crimp the use of huge amounts of so-called soft money in national political campaigns. Soft money is party-building political donations exempt from campaign finance limits. A spokesperson said the president plans a speech on the issue and will likely deliver it Friday in Santa Barbara. What does the president think? It's April Fool's Day? No, it is Halloween. Trick or treat. You're listening to Democracy Now! Bob Dole shocked many observers this year when he and his handlers decided to make his war wounds and permanent disability part of his presidential campaign. And Dole has raised the issue of disability rights again and again, taking credit for his work on the Historic Americans with Disabilities Act and telling voters about his own foundation that helps people with disabilities. Justin Dart is a trustee on the board of the Dole Foundation. He's a lifelong Republican and a principal architect of the ADA, who campaigned for both Ronald Reagan and George Bush and served five presidential appointments in their administrations. Dart even paid for a wheelchair ramp to the front door of Republican National Committee. Although Dart has supported Bob Dole in every campaign since 1988, in 1996, he's backing Bill Clinton. In a recent press conference with other disability rights activists, Justin Dart explained why.
Bob Dole's campaign claims he is, and I quote, America's foremost advocate for people with disabilities, unquote. And Bob Dole implies that his agenda is our agenda. And most people with disabilities say no. Now, I'm a Republican. I respect Bob Dole. I've supported him in every campaign since 1986. I love the man. but I love the American dream more. And I have made a painful decision of conscience. In 1996, I am a Republican for Clinton. Now, during the last 6 months, I've traveled to each of the 50 states. I met face-to-face with more than 6,800 disability rights leaders representing all major disability groups. And I asked them their views on the issues. And I told them, colleagues, get into politics as if your lives depended on it, because they do. 2,788 of my colleagues in the disability community, the leaders who know the issues best, volunteered to participate publicly in the presidential election, to be a voice for justice in the campaign through active support for one of the major presidential candidates. 227 volunteered to participate in the campaign for Bob Dole. 2,538 for Clinton. Perot 16, Nader 7. Bob Dole is a brother in disability. He has supported people with disabilities in many ways for many years, but now he has joined the Gingrich group in a tragic politics of retreat that I believe will condemn millions of Americans with disabilities to unemployment, welfare, and charity, to isolation in institutions and back rooms, to poor health, and for many, to early death. The Dole-Gingrich team voted to weaken the authority of USA to guarantee opportunity for all. In the midst of record highs for stocks, profits, and millionaire incomes, they voted to cut taxes for the well-to-do and to ration investments in the health, education, productivity, and dignity of our own children. Now, this is wrong. It violates family values, religious values, and business values. It will increase welfare and debt. It will reduce the productivity, the quality of life, and the power of USA to compete in the world. Every business, every family, every American will suffer. Now, Bill Clinton is the first to admit that he has not hit a home run on every issue, but his disability batting average is far superior to that of the Dole-Gingrich team. Against a tidal wave of negative politics, Bill Clinton has led us to a growing economy and a reduced deficit. He has fought to maintain the responsibility of the United States to empower all of its citizens. He has included people with disabilities as never before in his administration, in the decision-making process. He has defended the ADA, the IDEA, Medicaid, and the services that empower us to work and to live in dignity. After two decades of decline, the employment of people with severe disabilities is beginning to grow. But what about character? Bob Dole says that character is number one, and I agree, and that's why I support Bill Clinton. The character that has distinguished every great American president, from Washington and Jefferson to Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt, is the courage to stand for the empowerment of all against the tyranny of the few. Bill Clinton has the character to stand up to the gun lobbies, the tobacco and health care lobbies, the lobbies for deficit spending, and the lobbies for tax cuts for millionaires. Bill Clinton has the character to put people first. Now, question, why did I make this trip? Am I out to get another presidential appointment? No job. That's a promise. I'm a citizen advocate. Who paid for this trip? I paid, and a few colleagues, not the Clinton-Gore campaign. I made this trip because the lives of millions are at stake, and I made this trip to join my colleagues in the disability community in a message. Mr. President, Senator Dole, Speaker Gingrich, America, we, the people with disabilities, are not going to be second-class citizens anymore. We have a vision that is worthy of America. Vision: implement ADA and IDEA for all, health care for all, jobs for all, homes, transportation, communications, communities that are accessible to all, home and community-based services for all, legal services for all, choices for all. You choose your own doctor and treatment, your own career and home. Let no American ever again be forced into an institution or a nursing home. Let no American ever again die because someone thinks our lives are not worth living. Vision: reform government and welfare, balance the budget. Absolutely, but not at the expense of our citizens with disabilities and the generations of our children in the 21st century. Let all pay their fair share. No tax cuts for the well-to-do until all Americans have access to the dream. Pass power to the people, not to the governors, not to the health care companies. Create government that empowers all the people to produce and to live the good life. Mr. President, Senator Dole, Speaker Gingrich, America, let us lift our eyes from the PACs and the polls to the dream. Let us reject the politics of hostility, scandal, self-indulgence, and retreat. Let us respect and embrace each other, Republicans, Democrats, independents. Let us go forward together to create free enterprise for all, America for all. Let us go forward together to keep the sacred pledge, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Justin Dart, trustee on the board of the Dole Foundation, a lifelong Republican and principal architect of the Americans with Disabilities Act. He campaigned for both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, yet this time, although he has supported Bob Dole in the past, said he has to come out for President Clinton. He was speaking at the National Press Club last week. Right now, we're joined by Jim Dixon. He's director of Americans with Disabilities Vote, and one of the leaders in the Motor Voter Coalition, which can be credited with passage of the National Voter Registration Law. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Jim.
It's nice to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us about what your group, Americans with Disabilities Vote, has accomplished for this election?
We, for the first time, Americans with Disabilities are participating in the electoral process all around the country. In Los Angeles, on the 19th of October, we held the Night of 1,000 Votes, where 1,000 individuals with disability came together, collectively voted their absentee ballot, and to hand them over to the state election officials. In Minnesota, we are a nonpartisan operation, and so we don't endorse candidates. Our purpose is to just get people with disabilities out and voting. In Minnesota, we're making 20,000 calls to people. In Texas, we did a phone bank last weekend with the Coalition of Texans with Disabilities, urging people to vote, and discovered that 95% of the people we reached had used the disabled absentee ballot or early voting and had already voted.
Huh. What about the percentage of disabled people who vote, higher or lower than the average voter?
It's about 20% lower than the average voter. The National Voter Registration Act is gradually turning that around. Motor voter allows you to register to vote not only at the motor vehicle office, but the disability agency. So if you sign up for independent living, or you're going to get talking books, or you're a quad and you're getting home services, then the agency that gives you those services is to offer you the opportunity to register to vote.
And this was a real battle to get this passed.
Yeah. Well, our country has been unique amongst industrial democracies. It's the only place where the burden of voter registration was on the citizen. The National Voter Registration Act turns that around. It makes it government's affirmative responsibility to have people offer registration to people at any point of contact with the government. We believe that the real reason why there isn't a safety net, why our politics are so skewed, is really that the poorest third of the citizenry have systematically been cut out of the electorate by voter registration rules, purging rules. By the year 2000, we think we'll have about 92% of Americans will be able to vote because they will have been given the opportunity to register. It'll be the first time in the Republic's history.
Do you think it's deliberate that a third of the population has not been voting, that it's has been discouraged, lots of obstacles have been put in the way, and that you're talking about the poorest Americans?
Is the sky blue? Yeah. I mean, it's the reasons why people don't vote are complicated. You know, there's all of the barriers. You know, there's a definition of Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh and Philadelphia surrounded by Alabama. Well, part of that is that Pennsylvania maintained one of the most vigorous purging procedures. You fail to vote in 2 years of elections, you were removed from the rolls. What that meant was you vote for president. If you fail to vote in the school board election, the dog catcher election, the whatever, come the next congressional election, you go to the polls, you're not on the books. What has happened has been political candidates package their appeal not to the public at large, but to the, quote, likely voter. What does that mean? The first thing a pollster asks somebody is, are you registered to vote? We think by disability agencies, welfare, WIC, food stamps now, Medicaid must ask people when you apply for that service, are you registered to vote? Do you want to register right now?
Now, what about the states, the number of states where there is immediate registration on Election Day?
There are seven states where you can actually vote on Election Day. North Dakota has no voter registration rules. You walk into the polling place, you sign your name, you go in and vote. In Maine, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Wyoming, you can register to vote at the polling place on Election Day.
Why isn't this the case all over the country?
Well, you know, how white are the states that I just mentioned?
What about New York? You've been having quite a battle there.
It took us years. There have been 12 million more people able. There are now 12 million more people able to vote this November, next Tuesday, than there were in 94. That growth overwhelmingly and quite interestingly is in the South. The industrial states of the Northeast and California have resisted, dragged their feet. We had to bring them into court. It's been a clear and deliberate attempt by the incumbent governors in those states to prevent this law from happening. New York State, we had to bring to court a couple of times. They finally started seriously implementing the law, offering voter registration. But guess what? They started when it was too late for people to vote for this election.
Jim Dixon, in addition to talking about people with disabilities, when you talk about voting and obstacles to voting, you're talking about the poor, you're talking about people on Medicaid. What about these last 4 years under President Clinton with the passage of welfare repeal and other such draconian measures? How has that affected people with disabilities?
We've seen the real fight is there have been lots of attempts to cut services and cut programs. Transportation, not just to the polls, but every day, is the biggest problem facing Americans with disabilities. Public funding for paratransit, for systems that will take you to where you want to go, has been cut by 44%. The most serious cuts, the biggest fight for us, is going to be around the federal definition of Medicaid. When they're talking, we got to do away with entitlements, one of the things they're talking about is letting each state decide what medical coverage is, who gets Medicaid, who doesn't. Right now, if you're disabled, you're on Medicaid, they got to get you a wheelchair. I am sure, and we've seen attempts and trial balloons, to tie that wheelchair only to, say, employment. If you can't demonstrate you're going to get a job, you know, you don't get the chair.
Jim, we have to wrap up. What is the number of Americans with Disabilities Vote if people want to get in touch with your organization?
202-832-6564 or 1-800-55-VOTE. 1-800-55-VOTE.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jim Dixon, Director of Americans with Disabilities Vote, and that number, 1-800-55-VOTE. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Just a correction on that number for the Americans with Disabilities Vote. It's 1-800-55-VOTER. That's 1-800-55-VOTER. And you can figure out what those numbers are on your push buttons. But speaking of phone numbers, yesterday we encouraged people to call in to share with us, who it is you're going to be voting for, and also to comment on the debate we had yesterday on the privatization of Social Security, something that both Republicans and Democrats are talking about, just not right now before the election. And this is what people had to say.
Hello, my name is Sean Mason. I voted, actually my first election was not back in 1980. I voted independent John Anderson. Since then I voted Democratic after all the information that I've seen in the last two or three years in reference to special interest monies and basically buying of politicians. I'm voting the Green Party for Ralph Nader this year.
My name is Mary. I'm calling from New York City, and I'm just calling to say, yes, I am going to vote. I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader. I'm voting for now Ralph Nader because I know that he's interested in poor people and workers' people's rights. He may not win, but by our voting for him, it may start a movement to change things. I think the Democrat Republican Party are both corrupt, and I just think that we're going to be in bed and more dire straits in the future than we are now if we don't change the situation. As far as privatizing Social Security, I think the people who are behind that are a bunch of thugs and liars. I think they're just a bunch of greedy people that's lined up at the trough, and there may be some problems with Social Security. I think those problems need to be straightened out, but I certainly don't think that we should privatize.
I'm calling from Los Angeles. I certainly oppose this privatization. It'll be nothing but crookedness, and everybody will be getting their finger in the pie just like all the crooks do now in government.
My name is Susana Monteverde. I listen to you in Houston through KPFD. I'm voting for Nader, much of it because of what I've heard on your show. It's a tough choice. I certainly don't want Dole to win, but my conscience just won't let me vote for Clinton. And thank you for all your work. I hope you keep it up after the election.
And yes, we will be continuing for another year at least beyond the election. So thank you for those calls. We've gotten lots of more. You see a lot of Nader voters there. What do you think? Who are you going to be voting for? Will you be voting at all? And what do you think are the key issues that will determine your decision? Give us a call at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999. Extension 313. That's our listener comment line. One of the hottest congressional races in the country is taking place in Northwest California, in a district that has changed hands from Democrats to Republican each election since 1988. This year, the 46-year-old Republican incumbent, former police officer and small businessman Frank Riggs, is being challenged by 28-year-old Democrat Michaela Alioto. She's a San Francisco native who moved into the district just a year ago after working almost 3 years in Washington as a domestic policy advisor to Vice President Al Gore. If she defeats Riggs, Alioto will be the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky has this profile of the Riggs-Alioto race.
While there is no typical congressional district among the 70 or 80 House contests thought to be competitive across the country this year, there are typical campaigns being conducted in those districts. Not surprisingly, those campaigns are being conducted largely on the airwaves, with expensive, mostly negative television advertising. Here in California's vast 1st congressional district, although there isn't a dominant TV market that reaches its 1,500 square miles, both the Republican incumbent and his Democratic challenger are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars hoping that their ad messages can break through television's commercial clutter.
They were our grandmothers and great-aunts, and they left us a precious legacy. At a time when women were regarded as second-class citizens, they stood firm and demanded the right to vote. It is a special gift from their generation to us and our daughters. Michaela Alioto failed to vote in the last four elections. She says she just forgot. Frank Riggs will never forget. Frank Riggs, our values, our future, our congressman.
Congressman Frank Riggs's attack on Alioto's failure to vote in California during years when she lived part of the time in Washington, D.C., is one of several criticizing her for only recently moving to the district, failing to pay property taxes on time, and for opposing the death penalty, even in such notorious cases as that of kidnapper and murderer Richard Allen Davis. Frank Riggs, however, says these negative ads are legitimate.
All we're doing is, I think you have to stress both the positives and you have to bring out the facts about your opponent. I've gotten to know her well enough on a personal basis now to find her very likable as a person. She is a nice, earnest young lady. She's a young lady who's in a big hurry to get to elective office. But on the other hand, I think it's perfectly legitimate to point out that she moved here, bought a home in the district for the sole and express purpose of running for Congress. I think it's perfectly legitimate to point out that someone who wants to vote for us in Congress failed to exercise their own basic responsibility as a citizen to vote in the last four elections before voting for herself in Congress. And I think it's perfectly legitimate to point out that someone who is very proud of the fact that she was a quote-unquote domestic policy advisor in the administration that gave us the largest tax increase in American history after promising a middle-class tax cut failed to pay her own taxes in a full and timely manner.
Also typical of the 1996 national campaign is the influence of outside, so-called soft money in the 1st Congressional District. Riggs is being supported by the Republican National Committee, which has spent a reported $400,000 to run commercials criticizing Alioto's commercials, which attacked him for his anti-labor voting record.
Seen these attack ads? The big labor bosses in Washington are spending big money spreading big lies to buy their control of Congress. Here in California, they're running ads in favor of Michaela Alioto. The big labor bosses are tax and spend liberals. They fought welfare reform, stopped term limits, blocked a balanced budget. But they're spending big bucks on Michaela Alioto. The big labor bosses. Big money, big lies, big liberals.
Michaela Alioto believes the negative advertising blitz is a sign of weakness on the part of Frank Riggs' campaign, as the Republican, who's served two non-consecutive terms in Congress, feels the pressure of a possible Democratic trend in California, where Bill Clinton is heavily favored over Bob Dole.
Frank Riggs says it because he has nothing else to say. He says it because he's not going to sit here before you and start talking about the environment. He's not going to sit here and start talking about jobs. He's not going to sit here and start talking about education or Medicare. And that is exactly why you see personal attacks, is because you can't run on the issues. We are trying our darndest to keep it as issue-related as possible. But it's tough. It's really tough.
Alioto, of course, has her own negative ads running against Riggs, including one which identifies him with this year's electoral bete noir, Newt Gingrich, with whom Riggs, a vocal supporter of the Contract with America, voted 92% of the time in the last Congress.
More a year in premiums. And Riggs voted to cut education and to roll back environmental safeguards. Riggs voted to end nursing home protections and voted with Newt Gingrich 92% of the time. Frank Riggs, a congressman voting for Newt Gingrich and against Northern California families.
In addition to the ad wars, there's another typical aspect to the Riggs-Alioto campaign, the two candidates' denial that they really want to be conducting this kind of campaign at all. Frank Riggs and Michaela Alioto both say they'd rather be discussing issues, and they at least agree on what one of those issues should be, jobs and the environment.
In our district, I realize the common denominator in our district is our bountiful natural resources. Now, agriculture, as broadly defined, is the largest and most important industry in the district, whether we're talking about the forest products industry in the northern part of the district or the wine grape growing industry in the central and southern portions of the district. Those natural resources create a dynamic tension of their own because we have to balance our concern about the environment on the one hand, the protection and you know, wise, the conservation, wise stewardship of our natural resources on the one hand, with our concerns about jobs and the economy on the other hand. And it's ironic because our natural resources are not only sort of our economic source of our economic livelihood, but they're also very important to our quality of life, which has attracted so many people here to begin with.
For Riggs, the key to an environmentally sound economy is jobs, including jobs in the logging industry. He co-sponsored the controversial timber salvage measure in Congress.
It basically gives the Forest Service the authority to sell to private bidders on the open market, you know, through regular federal competitive bidding rules, the dead, dying, and diseased trees on federal forest lands. That has the effect of increasing, of course, harvesting on federal forest lands. I support that legislation. I helped write it. I believe the timber salvage legislation is good for fire suppression purposes and for the health of the forest land. It obviously, again, improves the timber harvest on federal forest lands and ensures a log supply to our independent mills. What I want to do is I want to spend more money on restoring fish and wildlife habitat. I want to create tax incentives for property owners so that ultimately we don't end up with a situation like we've had in Northwest California for years and years and years with the spotted owl, basically contributing to the shutdown of these independent mills and this tremendous downturn in the forest products industry.
But Alioto reminds voters that Riggs is one of the League of Conservation Voters' so-called Dirty Dozen, and Riggs has a zero environmental voting record from some conservation organizations. Alioto says that Riggs-sponsored measures like the timber salvage rider are part of the problem.
One rider that Mr. Riggs wrote, or an amendment to the Interior 1996 budget bill, which basically gave a direct exemption from 37,000 acres of privately owned timberland. It gave them an exemption from the Endangered Species Act. This was under the notion and the whole idea, according to him, that most of this land were small ranches and small businesses. Well, of the 37,000 acres, 32,000 acres were Maxim, Pacific Lumber. It was a direct corporate giveaway without question. And the fact of the matter is that it died on the floor of Congress because 81 mostly moderate Republicans voted against it.
There have been a number of demonstrations and rallies and protests, some of them militant, all of them pretty nonviolent. You haven't been a part of those physically. You haven't been up there. There was one that had even 5,000 people not so long ago. Why not?
One of the great things about this district is that people stand up for their beliefs. And any time you see a group of people the size of the Headwater rallies, or protests, it is not only remarkable, but I think it's intrinsically American. It's like, the union's going on strike. We are standing up for what we believe in. I think that when we look at what's going on, we always need to retain a voice, and that we always need to be a part of it. And when we look at the way we came to a conclusion with Headwaters, we had Senator Feinstein there, we had John Campbell from Pacific Lumber, we had a representative from both Department of Interior with John Garamendi and from Pete Wilson's office, but we didn't have our timber workers, and we didn't have our conservationists or environmentalists, the people who live in the community.
And we didn't have Michaela Alioto. You weren't there.
At the rally. No, I was not at the rally, in part because this is a big district and because it is 1,500 square miles. And I believe we were in Napa that day. There's no question about the fact that Headwaters is a very important issue.
For both Riggs and Alioto, the electoral challenge this year is made more difficult by the fine line each tries to walk on issues like logging and the Headwaters Forest. But many of Alioto's supporters, like one woman who attended a recent rally with a distinct countercultural flavor on the Mendocino Coast, don't blame her for not being more outspoken.
I think that it would be disadvantageous at this point in the election, right before an election, to take a strong stand on a controversial issue. And I think that perhaps she thought that out.
So you can still support Mikhail Alioto even though she hasn't been, you know,
yes,
way out in front on this?
Yes, and the reason I can is because I've spoken to her personally on more than one occasion, and she was one of the few politicians that I've ever spoke to that actually were listening to me when I spoke to them. I don't have to agree with a candidate on every single issue. What I want is to know that they're going to listen to what I think about any issue and take it into consideration.
Both candidates have been traveling extensively and exhaustingly through this huge district in recent weeks, meeting, as Frank Riggs did last weekend, with supporters at rallies, house parties, and picnics.
Gosh. Yeah, I want one myself. That's super.
They didn't have the headquarters.
I have a bumper sticker like that. And my wife was just thrilled when she saw that, you know. Dole, Kemp, Riggs. I mentioned we had Elizabeth Dole in Eureka a couple nights ago.
Oh, really?
We had an overflow crowd. The paper said 600. The fire marshal said closed it down at, he had one of those hand clickers doing a head count. He closed it down at 820 bodies. And there were several hundred more people outside that kind of lined the motorcade route.
I think you're doing one heck of a good job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, we're full support. And I'm an IBEW AFL-CIO member, and I support you.
Thank you.
Not the union's idea. Just
that.
Upper management union support.
I know it.
It's
I
not
know.
The union workers.
I know it. I mean, you know, the rank-and-file workers I talk to who are the salt of the earth, the backbone of the community, they tell me, I mean, a lot of them are socially and fiscally conservative, and they tell me they support
That's
common sense reforms that we started.
It's just the upper echelon, and the police association's the same thing. It's not the guy on the beat.
Yeah.
The guy on the beat supports conservatism. It doesn't support all this liberal garbage.
There have been no published polls taken in the 1st Congressional District. Everyone, including the candidates, however, seems to agree that the Riggs-Alioto race is too close to call. Who wins may well be decided by two factors. First, there's a Libertarian Party candidate, Emil Rossi, in the race. He's a 71-year-old hardware store owner who filed on the last possible day, and his candidacy might hurt Riggs if the vote is close. Secondly, no one can predict what the turnout will be like, especially if, as expected, East Coast presidential results show an overwhelming Clinton victory early in the evening, 3 hours before the polls close in California. Such an early end to what little suspense remains at the top of the ticket might favor Riggs. All of the 8 daily newspapers in the district have endorsed Riggs for re-election, but the region's outspoken independent weekly, the Anderson Valley Advertiser, endorses Alioto. Its editor is Bruce Anderson, who's lived in the 1st Congressional District for 25 years.
The district's a volatile district. It's changed parties now back and forth between Democrats and Republicans 4 times in the last decade. And it looks like there's a strong possibility, anyway, that it may change again, although Alioto is being damned for her youth, her inexperience, her failure to vote in the last 2 elections, and some minor tax problems.
Anderson says that the Headwaters logging controversy may not be as much of a factor as all the publicity around it might seem to indicate.
Well, I think it's a factor, but we always have to remember in the 1st Congressional District that the bulk of the voting population is essentially urban, which is at the southern part of the district. But I think Headwaters, certainly in this area, is a key issue. I think Alioto is in a jam because she has sort of the albatross of the National Democratic Party, whose policy is changing on the issue and is likely to change again in the spring after the winters when there's a revival of direct action in the Headwaters Forest. So she's hemmed in there, while any knowledgeable persons on the timber industry know that Riggs really hasn't done anything for the timber industry. And the media feeds into that, too, because they talk to management people all the time and represent these people as loggers. The loggers know, even the dimmest logger knows, that his livelihood has literally gone to other countries. Value-added timber work is now done abroad, Mexico, Venezuela, and other places. Everybody knows that Riggs represents people who own things, and he represents the timber owners.
A couple of elections ago, you had a Peace and Freedom Party candidate who took, I believe, 15% of the vote and really was responsible for the Republican Riggs getting elected in 1990 because she took so many votes away from the Democrat. And then she disappeared. The left presence disappeared. This is a year when Ralph Nader is making something of an effort nationwide and in California. There's no green candidate running in this district where there's so much environmental spirit. What's going on up here? Why don't we see more ballot activity from the left?
That's a very good question, and that's one that I've thought about and written about much over the years. It's certainly very frustrating. I think it's an old problem with the left. It's certainly a problem with the left here that we all talk a good ball game, but when it comes time to have a reliable phone number, a reliable phone tree, and a real effort to identify and back a progressive candidate, too many leftists tend to sneer at that kind of activity. I mean, I've had persons, self-identified leftists and self-identified progressives, say things like, oh, the electoral system is too corrupt, I'm just not going to participate. But we're not even in the ballgame because we are not an electoral presence. If you're not an electoral presence, you're not present.
A final typical aspect of the Riggs-Alioto 1996 contest is the seeming lack of interest and enthusiasm on the part of the vast majority of those who live in the district. Although both the Riggs and Alioto campaigns say they have hundreds of volunteer workers and precinct organizers, a recent three-day, 550-mile tour of the region found almost no lawn signs or bumper stickers for either candidate. And an informal survey of a dozen people at a recent fair in the southern part of the district failed to turn up one person who could name, without prompting, either of the candidates running. But that may well change as Election Day approaches and the unavoidable television ad blitz roars on.
One defied his own party, leading the fight to raise the minimum wage and making jobs his top priority. The others
for Pacifica Radio, I'm Larry Bensky in Berkeley, California.
Term limits and the death penalty. The other one doesn't. One is a veteran and
thank you for that report, Larry. Coming up, we'll talk to Neighbor to Neighbor, a national grassroots organization that has chosen the Riggs-Alioto contest as one of its targeted races. We'll find out where else they're working. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You remember those ads a few years ago that Ed Asner narrated that was a cup of coffee, but in fact a cup of blood? And it was advertising a boycott against Salvadoran coffee because of the oligarchy there. Well, they were put together by a group called Neighbor to Neighbor, a grassroots organization that works for human rights and economic justice. And during this election year, they have a political action committee, unlike other PACs. Instead of giving money to campaigns, Neighbor to Neighbor is giving in-kind donations of trained organizers to help get out the vote in close congressional races. Joining us now to talk about their efforts is Shelley Moskowitz. She's political director of the Neighbor to Neighbor Political Action Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Shelley.
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be here.
So tell us, how did you go from boycotting Salvadoran coffee to getting organizing going in races around the country for the 96 elections?
Well, in fact, we started our Neighbor to Neighbor PAC in 1986. We were working to cut off military aid to the Contras, and as I'm sure most of the listeners remember, the votes would go back and forth, back and forth. We'd win one, we'd lose one, and these are the dark days of the Reagan era. We decided that we needed to trade bad Contra aid votes for good ones. So we sent our trained organizers into some key races in 1986. We helped elect Louise Slaughter in New York, David Skaggs in Colorado, and we helped save Alan Cranston's California Senate seat in 1986. And so in 1996, the goal of our political organizing is to break the right wing's control of Congress. The human rights issue that we're currently organizing around is for universal health care. And if anyone's been awake the last 2 years, you know that this Congress has made a right-wing assault on our existing national health programs, Medicare, Medicaid. We've been fighting those defensive battles, but we want to change the political climate, we want to change the debate, and we want to elect a new Congress and then hold them accountable so that we can move towards our goal of universal health care.
It sounds like what you're doing is supporting Democrats, like you talked about saving Alan Cranston's seat in California, but Democrats as well certainly support the Contras in Contras in Nicaragua and sort of supported the oligarchy in El Salvador and supported military aid to El Salvador at the time.
And that's where grassroots organizing can make the difference. When you put pressure on members of Congress, they're held more accountable. And we did change those policies. We defeated military aid to the Contras. It was the first foreign policy defeat for Ronald Reagan. We got a negotiated settlement to the war in El Salvador. And we will get universal health care. We're in it for the long haul.
Well, we just heard Larry Bensky's piece on the Riggs-Alioto race. Tell us how you're organizing in that district.
We have set up an extensive volunteer precinct operation. We have targeted precincts in the city of Napa, particularly, that we are responsible for. We are pulling out the occasional voters, the folks who will vote the right way but don't always make it to the polls. By recruiting a volunteer army of local precinct leaders, we're doing neighbor-to-neighbor grassroots organizing. Over the last several weeks, our organizers have been training the local activists. They are contacting their neighbors, identifying the good votes. And then this weekend, we'll be doing GOTV, Get Out the Vote rallies, and our precinct leaders will take responsibility on Election Day for seeing that those good voters get to the polls. We'll be checking the polls every 2 hours. We have a high level of accountability. Each precinct leader will work their list of good votes down to zero by the time the polls close. And the day after the election, when we win, we'll be able to show who made that difference.
Now, you said universal health care is really your major issue. Has that been an issue in the campaign between Alioto and Riggs?
It's one of many issues. With this right-wing Congress, so many of our most cherished values are under assault. And so health care is one issue, certainly respect for workers' dignity and environmental issues have all been key. And we are tapping into that concern that the grassroots has.
Can you tell us about your other races and how you chose them?
Sure. There are three basic criteria for us. One is we work for progressive candidates who will be leaders in the new Congress, who will be voices for our issues. Two, we work to defeat right-wingers who oppose and block our agenda. And three, it is very important that we are in races where we can make the margin of difference. So we look for those toss-up races. A good precinct operation can increase voter turnout by 2 to 5%. And so turnout in this election is going to be key. We always say that, you know, the millions of dollars that get spent on media and mailings, hopefully we'll get a candidate at least to third base. But it takes a grassroots precinct operation that's highly accountable to steal home.
So talk about some of those races.
Well, we are in some great ones. In New England, we are working for Deborah Arne Arneson against Congressman Bass in New Hampshire. She is going to be a great voice for the progressive community when we get her in. She's a dynamo. In Massachusetts, we're working for Jim McGovern, that many people may remember for his work on Central America policy as a legislative aide. He is up against Congressman Peter Blute in the Worcester, Massachusetts area. In California, we have the real battleground for control of the Congress. We're in five key races, as Larry spoke about the Alioto Riggs race in Northern California. We're working in Alameda County against Congressman Bill Baker. We want to get the only right-winger out of the Bay Area. And we are in the very famous Andrea Seastrand-Walter Capps race in Santa Barbara. That was a race that was Seastrand won that race by 1,500 votes 2 years ago. If what that means is if 16 more people in 100 precincts had turned out, there would have been a different outcome to that race. We can guarantee that those extra voters get out.
How are you doing it there?
Exactly the same program as I described in the Alioto race. It's a tried and true method of recruiting a volunteer army. Let me also say that in Southern California, we're in two great races. The Moorhead open seat in Pasadena, Burbank. We're working for Doug Kahn, who is a strong supporter of universal health care. And we've also been brought into the Bob Dornan Loretta Sanchez race. We're going to help dump B1 bomber Bob. And we're very excited about that. Race has tightened up in the last few days. It's now 43-43. It's a statistical dead heat, and we're going to put Loretta over the top.
We're talking to Shelley Moskowitz, political director of the Neighbor to Neighbor Political Action Committee. Why aren't you working for any Greens around the country?
Well, I think the work that the Greens are doing is very important. We, as I said, go where we think we can make the difference. If a candidate can get themselves to third base, we can steal home. But they have to be in the running. A grassroots operation cannot bridge a gulf that is more than 2 to 5 points.
I noticed that in 1990, you worked on Harvey Gantt's campaign in North Carolina. Now, again, a very close race between Harvey Gantt and the incumbent Republican Jesse Helms. Are you doing any work there now?
No, we decided to focus our primary effort on winning back the House. Harvey Gantt is running an excellent race. He has raised a lot of money. He is relying primarily on media and mailings and not on a field program. But we're strongly supportive and have endorsed him. But we felt we could make the biggest difference by giving him a House of Representatives with a better agenda.
Now, you're a PAC that gives people power, not money. What is your assessment of the power of the money? You could call it the sort of trick-or-treat campaign this year, which is that you give us money, we work for you, and God forbid you're poor and you don't give us money, and you'll see what happens. I guess you get bills like laws like welfare repeal.
Exactly. Well, you know, media and mailings, it may do a lot for the campaign, but it does nothing to empower voters. And in fact, the negative ads and the opposition research, it only suppresses voter turnout. I think the grassroots organizing we do can invigorate a community, and it, as I said, it can make the margin of victory.
You know, one of the things we've talked about is the fact that political consultants get a kickback every time they buy ad time on a television station. They will make something like 16% to 17% back. It's why President Clinton's Dick Morris made a hell of a lot of money in addition to getting money from the DNC, getting money from these campaigns. So it leads them to push toward doing TV campaigns and not grassroots organizing, where they personally are not going to make money.
Exactly. We find that many campaigns overlook the importance of a field operation. It seems old-fashioned, but when the race gets very close, we get these frantic calls at the end.
You also have the media, of course, that benefits tremendously, so they're not going to be covering your kind of race. Or do you get much TV coverage since they're making so much money off of these ads?
We've been so busy working in the field that we've probably not been noticed by even Larry Binsky wandering around the district with the candidates. I think these are stories that get missed. And so that's actually why I'm very happy to be on the show today, because this is a story that people, I think, will feel good about and want to participate in.
Shelley, what is the number of the Neighbor to Neighbor Political Action Committee if people just want to find out what you're doing possibly in their areas?
Well, let me say there's two different ways that people can help. One is you can come out on Election Day, volunteer with our Get Out the Vote operation. And two, you can join Neighbor to Neighbor. And if you believe in our grassroots organizing, give us become a member, send a financial contribution. Our 1-800 number is 1-800-366-8289.
Again?
1-800-366-8289. It's a phone number that was left over from the coffee boycott. If you spell it out, it says 1-800-DON'T-BUY.
Well, I don't think we should buy this stuff this year either. Don't buy the elections. That's a pretty good statement.
That's right. Let's win them with the real people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, Shelley Moskowitz of Neighbor to Neighbor. And again, folks, we are looking for your input, not financial input right now, but we're looking for your comments. Who are you going to be voting for? What are the races you're looking at? What are the issues you care about? Call us on our comment line. We're playing those until the election. Give us a call at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Well, speaking of neighbors, we thought it would be interesting to find out how people living in other countries are viewing the U.S. elections, especially our neighbor to the south, Mexico, since the political and economic fates of our two countries are so intertwined. As anti-immigrant rhetoric becomes a powerful feature of many campaigns and the fallout of the North American Free Trade Agreement goes largely unaddressed, we asked reporter Jana Schroeder to speak with Mexican citizens about the U.S. elections.
U.S. elections may seem far away from this busy corner in Cuernavaca, a city an hour south of Mexico City, but it's not so far removed, since everyone here has family or friends who live in the United States. While most here don't know many details of the campaigning, everyone has an opinion.
Pues cómo no nos va a importar que haya las elecciones de allá. Nos importa porque allá hay gente de nosotros de aquí de México.
How could it not matter to us that elections are happening there? It's important to us because some of our own people, our fellow Mexicans, are there. What we're interested in is how Mexican migrant workers are treated on the job. We're interested in the laws they're being subjected to, the resources they're receiving, and more than anything, all the racism in the United States.
21-year-old Miguel works at his family's restaurant above this noisy street. He says he'd like to see a presidential candidate who recognizes that immigrants are part of the labor force in the U.S. and that all workers should receive decent treatment. But he knows they're not the only ones who matter.
Pues sí, primero trato a su pueblo, su propio pueblo de norteamericano.
What's most important is how they treat their own people and that there's a fair distribution of the wealth, because it looks to me like in the United States, too, the rich are getting richer, and there are more and more poor people.
30-year-old Toño, who has a watch repair shop below the restaurant, is one of the millions of Mexicans who've seen with their own eyes the other side of the border.
Yo he tenido suerte porque yo he ido con pasaporte y no he tenido problemas, no he estado con familias.
But I've been lucky. I went with a passport. I didn't have any problems. I was with friends, with good people. I lived there for a year. Actually, I went to study English. I didn't work much.
Like Miguel, Toño is most concerned about the racism in the U.S. and the treatment of all immigrants, not just those from Mexico. But he's reluctant to believe what any candidate says before an election, and he doesn't think it's particularly important whether Clinton stays or Dole wins.
No, no veo gran diferencia, ¿no? Siento que va a ser lo mismo. Al principio va a haber un poco de cambio, pero va lo mismo.
I don't see any big difference. I think it'll be more of the same. In the beginning, we'll see a little bit of change. But then, the same old thing, the same old system. Right now, they're into making propaganda and all that, so they'll win. But you know, between Bush and Clinton, I didn't see any real difference.
Toño's mother, Teresa, comes over from her dress shop next door to join in the conversation. She's seen 7 of her 8 children give life a try in the U.S., both legally and illegally. And not all were as lucky as Toño. She says her youngest daughter was wrongly accused of drug trafficking, and one of her sons slept under a bridge until he could get enough money together to come back home. Another daughter returned when she got tired of the humiliating way she was treated at a meatpacking plant. Now one of her sons is thinking about going back, but the rest of the family is trying to convince him not to go. Economic conditions in Mexico have so deteriorated that especially young people continue to be tempted to cross the border, despite the risks. Doña Teresa says U.S. economic policies only make it worse.
Sí, que nos dejara crecer, que no interviniera en la política, que no se metiera.
If they'd just give us a chance to grow economically, if they wouldn't interfere in political matters, if they just wouldn't meddle so much. It's in their interest that Mexico is always asking for help, that it's always in debt, that our people keep going over there to look for work.
Like some in Mexico, she thinks recent economic policies promoting agreements like NAFTA have hurt more than helped. Now people want to buy imported things. The popularity of used clothes from the U.S. has hurt the sales at her shop. And she doesn't think much of U.S. economic assistance like Clinton's loan guarantee last year, which many believe was really designed to benefit the U.S., not Mexico.
No ayuda. El gobierno no ayuda, el de allá.
It doesn't help the government from over there. Yes, it offers loans, but it demands what it's going to get in return. And if it doesn't get it, well, then it just takes whatever it wants.
Like many Mexicans, Doña Teresa would like to see a more neighborly relationship with a U.S. president who respects Mexican sovereignty and recognizes the economic inequalities between the two countries. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Janice Schroeder in Cuernavaca, Mexico.
Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a look at redistricted districts in North Carolina and Texas, and we'll be talking to Ralph Nader. Stay tuned. Julie Drizin, our producer, Kenneth Mason, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Eastern Standard.
Standard Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 15 seconds. Universal Time, 14 hours, 59 minutes, 20 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Standard Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 30 seconds. Universal Time, 14...
And they took full advantage of it.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, and this week on Background Briefing, we're talking with Jack Blum, who testified recently before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's hearings into the Gary...